This program is proudly sponsored by Holistic Therapies by Camille. Fancying a full body massage with cup-in therapy to help you relax and release tension? Go to holistictherapiesbycamille.com to book yourself in.
Hello, and welcome to Joining the Dots, the show that focuses on connection, community, charity, and conversation, the things that bring us together as human beings. I'm Julie Kissick, and today we're talking about what many still see as the last taboo, the one thing that none of us can avoid, and yet so many of us never plan for. Any ideas what it is? I'll tell you after The Creatures and right now. Well, if you haven't guessed, we're talking about death. Would you know what a good death is? Would you know one if you saw one? Or probably more importantly, what would it take for you to have one? My guest today is a woman who saw her father experience what she believes to be a bad death, and she didn't want others to have the same experience. So she started to train as a death doula in order to support others who were living through the end of their life and who wanted someone to help them to navigate it. It's a fascinating and important conversation, and it was one I didn't know I needed, but I've certainly benefited from, and I hope you will too. Someone who's keen to open up that conversation is Mandy Carpenter, a videographer, a media lecturer, and a death doula. Mandy explained how she came to start her training.
So I think there were two things that happened. Firstly, I volunteer for Crews Bereavement, and I do a lot of support with people who are bereaved, children and adults. And what I noticed for a lot of these people was there were big traumas around death and what had happened when people had died. And some of this seemed to be, it seemed to be controllable in a weird sort of way. You know, it was people who, maybe left somebody in hospital when they were near the end and they could have been there when they died, but wasn't given the information they needed, for example. And this would give them some trauma after somebody died. And then when a similar sort of thing happened to me when my dad was dying, nobody told me he was dying and he didn't have a very good death. And after he died, that kind of, I used to think, there must be a better way we can manage death. And it kind of got me looking into ways of dying then. And I found the Death Doula organisation and looked at some of their work, and I found there were ways you could have a good death then.
What does a good death look like?
I suppose it can be very different for everybody. So for me, a good death would be being at home. It would be with my sons and my husband and my dog with me. There'd be other people I wouldn't want to be there for various reasons. But it might be that for somebody, it might be that they need to be in a hospital or a hospice because they might have medical conditions that people can't support at home. It's maybe having those things around you that you want to have around you. And that might be something like nature and windows, clean sheets. I suppose it's also thinking, what is a bad death? And that might be, say, being in a corridor and very busy A&E on your own, you know. And that's something, I think, with a bit of education, you can manage them.
And when we were talking initially and you were telling me what you were doing, it got me thinking. My mum died 15 years ago this year of cancer, and the cancer was a brutal cancer. She was with us less than 16 weeks from diagnosis to death. But she made the decision that she wanted to die at home. And having made that decision, it wasn't something that we could, as a family, so there's me, my brother, and my dad, and my dad was in his 70s at the time, it wasn't a decision that we could just get her out of hospital and get her home. You know, there was a process that had to be undertaken that was very new to us. We'd never been through that before. She needed a special bed. She needed nurses coming back and forth. The thing that struck me about that process was that she wasn't keen on talking. She didn't. I'm a journalist by trade. I ask lots of questions. It's in my nature. And I remember saying to her one evening before we brought her home, what about Dad? Does Dad want you to be at home? Because I knew from the conversations that we'd had with the hospital that she was going to have to be downstairs, which obviously meant that in my parents' house, there wasn't a downstairs toilet, for example. And I knew that my dad would have to do caring responsibilities that he would never have done before. And I know he was perfectly capable of doing that. And I'm sure that they probably had the conversation that she wasn't prepared to have with me or my brother. But it was a really hard thing as a daughter to sort of think, I don't know what you want. And I don't know whether you've had the conversation with my father. And is he okay to know that my mother is going to die in our living room? And I think there's still such a taboo around death that when we were talking, it got me fascinated because I thought, well, it's so important, isn't it? I mean, so many people don't have those conversations. And then for, I would imagine, a lot of people, whether you've got a belief, whether you've got a faith, whether you've got nothing, whether you think that the end is the end, and it's still something that none of us would have experienced before. So if you're not prepared mentally and things don't go the way that you would like them to, that must be awful.
Yeah, I think so. It can have a lot of effects through the rest of your life. But I think there is ways, I mean, as a society, the way we deal with death at the moment is fairly new. You know, before it would be a process that everybody would see someone dying in their house. They'd clean the body, they'd lay the body out, they'd sit with the body, and we've tend to push that away so we don't want to deal with it. And I think now there's maybe a sort of underground movement where we're going back to that because it helps us, I think, as part of the healing process as well, to see a natural death, or as natural as it can be. You know, I mean, as you know, with someone ravaged by cancer, it still can be painful and quite distressing death. So I think part of the doula role then is going out and maybe talking to people about the different things that can be done and put into place. And also maybe being a bit of a facilitator or somebody new who can kind of talk to somebody who doesn't have, like if they talk to your mum, maybe they don't have all that sort of history and she might not want to tell you because it's distressing you or upsetting you. So maybe she can tell a doula or somebody like that about her wishes, you know. So I think it's sort of trying to open that conversation.
And how have you found the reaction to the people that you know when you've told them what you're doing?
I think some people just say nothing. And they're just like, okay, what, you know, you could just see the look in their eyes like you're a lunatic or something. And then some people just will come and talk to me about it, either about something that's happened to them or something they might have thought about their own death and dying. So, I think, like you said, it's just trying to get that conversation going and get people, you know, my sons, for example, know that should I be involved in a car accident and I'm on a ventilator, I don't want that. That's not what I want in my life. I'm okay for them to turn off that, that artificial ventilation for me. So they don't, and that's written down as well. So that's not a big decision they have to make when they're under a lot of stress. So those type of things, I think, can be really important. And it's about what you want, but it also helps other people to know that's what you want as well when you're trying to make that decision, you know.
Meaningful conversations are important to us here on Joining the Dots, and I hope this one is one that many of you will benefit from.
And what does training look like? What have you done in your course?
Oh, okay. So we've done all sorts of things. So we have done, we started the basics then, you know, so it's about kind of listening to people and hearing is what they want. It's about maybe looking at how people want to manage their space if they're at end of life. You know, who do they want to come and see them? How do they want their room to be? Those kind of things too. At the other end are how to liaise with a range of people that might be caring for them. You know, might have nurses, doctors, physiotherapists, might have a whole range. How to facilitate that? How to work with family dynamics? How to talk about things like intimacy and bringing up conversations around that at end of life? How to talk about final wishes or legacy? How to give people space to talk about their lives and, you know, what they've done and what that means to them? And it's kind of, it'll also, you also reflect on yourself and your own death and the kind of things that might be triggers for you or, you know, might be difficult for you. So I have a kind of this weird thing where I am quite happy that I find disruptive families, I'm very comfortable with a disruptive family. You know, if I go in and, you know, dad's in the corner having a fag and the kids are arguing, I'm kind of very comfortable with that. But if it's a family that's very supportive and happy, I'm a little bit freaked out by that. So it's kind of knowing yourself and learning a bit about yourself as well.
I'm guessing that you will have learned things that you didn't know before, but what's been the sort of standout things?
That's a good question. I suppose it's that one of the standout things is the connection that you get with the people that you train with. You know, you're kind of going very in depth and, you know, you're really kind of laying bare either your fears or your hopes or things that you believe in, you know, and the organisation that runs the training, it's called Living Well, Dying Well. They really create a space where you feel very safe. So if you want to be vulnerable, you can be vulnerable. It never feels like there's any judgment or anything like that. So I think that's been, because, you know, obviously it's a very emotive topic. So it does bring up a lot of different things for people. So, yeah.
And what have your immediate family thought about it? Have they seen you as a good fit for this role?
Yeah, I think they think, because I'm not normally quite a calm person. I've never kind of shied away from talking about death or, you know, people who are terminally ill. Then, you know, I'm not somebody who kind of avoids that or even is the opposite way, where you get some people who kind of get pulled towards it. But I think my husband's very supportive. My two sons are very supportive, and the one son is a little bit like, I don't really want to talk about that. But he kind of knows where everything is and if he needs to deal with it. And, you know, I'm not going to push it on anybody.
And if someone is listening to this and they think using the services of a death doula,
yeah,
I don't suppose there's one size fits all. I suppose there's loads of different reasons why people would choose to use one. But if somebody did, what would be the process of them getting in touch?
So there's an organisation, Death Doula UK, and you could go on their website and they've got all the sort of doulas in your area and you can have a look at them. You know, some of them might have specialities, some of them might come from health, if that's something, you know, they might have been working in the health sector or they might not. Some of us are students, so you don't have to pay. Just travel expenses. The organisation itself can pay for you. That's what, you know, if it's about barrier to a doula, they don't want any barriers. So you can get on the site and have a good look around there. Or you can ring them, you know, if websites aren't your thing, you can give them a ring and have a chat with them. I always remember my son, who trained as a nurse, telling me about a farmer who wanted to die at home, but he had no family and he died in hospital. And I spoke to my son, said that there's this organisation called Death Doula UK, you know, it's there for people like that, so they can go home and they can die at home. Yeah.
And I suppose lots of people who don't have family, it would be the most incredible thing for them if they were able to have their final wishes. If you're someone with a terminal illness, for example, and you know that you've got 6 months to live, you could contact the organisation ahead of that, at the start of those 6 months, and presumably get to know the person that might spend the your last hours with you.
Yeah. And you might want them to help you, I don't know, do a memory book for children or a recipe book for your kid, you know, anything. You know, it might be something like that. It might be just sitting with them and holding space. It might just be helping the family have someone to offload on. It can be a whole range of things. You know?
And talking of offloading, I'm guessing that it's quite a difficult emotional thing to do, to be a death doula. So how do you manage those emotions?
So we all have a supervisor. So we do a debrief at the end of, you know, any support that we've done, and just get some sort of support from them. And I suppose it's really important that I have my own self-care. So I, you know, getting out in nature is a really big thing for me, and walking. So I try to plan that in if I'm doing that sort of work. And then, you know, I just try to have a little bit of time that's just nothing. You know, I'm not doing anything. So, yeah.
And have you found, since you've been doing the training, which is quite extensive, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
Have you found there being major challenges or minor challenges? Or
no, it's been okay. I had a lady that I supported, who I couldn't support as much as I wanted to due to my other work. So sometimes it's juggling that with doulas and what they're doing. So some people, they're okay with us coming in once a week on a Thursday, you know, 2 till 4. And other people may want us to be there right at the end for 24 hours and so on. So it's knowing what your doula can do then. So that's kind of part of that process as well.
Taylor Swift and Opalite here on Joining the Dots on Hospital Radio Glamorgan, your healthy choice. If you're listening to us on DAB, an especially warm welcome. And if you're one of our loyal listeners via our website, our app, or in the University Hospital of Wales, we're delighted you're here. Thank you so much for listening to Hospital Radio Glamorgan. Now, 10 of us, the cancer charity, offering information, advice and specialist support to those who are affected by cancer, is holding its Strictly Speakeasy Gala Dinner a week on Friday. That's March the 20th at the Coal Exchange in Cardiff. They're encouraging people to polish those spats, don some pearls even, and get ready to join them as they step back into the roaring 1920s. So if the Charleston or the Tango or the Foxtrot get you wanting to light up the dance floor, do get yourselves a ticket. And the big Brucey bonus is that Kai Widdrington and Katia Jones from Strictly Come Dancing will also be there. All of the details to book the tickets are available on the 10 of Us website. That's 10ofuscancercare.org.uk/strictly-speakeasy. That's 10ofuscancercare.org.uk/strictly-speakeasy. Now, we're all familiar with the phrase, in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. It was made famous by the American statesman Benjamin Franklin back in 1789, and it continues to be true today. None of us will escape death, and so many of us strive to have a good life. So why don't we consider the quality of our death too? Someone who's keen to open up that conversation is Mandy Carpenter, a videographer, a media lecturer and a death doula.
From the perspective of a Welsh audience, do you happen to know how many doulas there are in Wales?
There are not many. I think there are around 4 that are registered. That might have gone up a little bit, but we're trying really hard to get a little bit more information out there, people on the training. I think if we can get more people interested, they run training here, even if it's like just the foundation, because you can do the foundation course without doing the diploma, and that gives you really good grounding for doing this. So,
and would doulas work with the NHS? Would they work with other doulas?
Have worked with the NHS, yeah. Yeah, and they kind of run volunteers who might also do doula work as well. And we've got two doulas who are starting to go into prisons as well. So I definitely, it's a growing movement. And I think one of the things, one of the interesting things about that, or seeing how things go with the assisted dying bill and how kind of doulas fit into that, whether people will see us as somebody who works with assisted dying, which we don't, you know, sort of independent of that.
Because you would imagine that, for example, a GP, if you're somebody who doesn't have children, who doesn't have a partner, and you're given a terminal diagnosis,
yes.
We know from people like Marie Curie and those sorts of organisations how important those last weeks and months can be.
Yeah.
But if you've got nobody to talk to, and maybe you're somebody who feels that you can't impose on your friends, or you feel it as an imposition and that kind of thing, then you would imagine that if GPs could, or nurses or whatever, could point people to the organisation, then that could be a real help to people.
I think in the southeast and around London, it's a big movement, you know, and they do a lot of work with health centres, GPs, local hospitals. And I think they're hoping that will be something that spreads out nationally. Yeah, because I think it's important. I don't think people know, you know, and there's training you could do in the whole community to get people to be supportive and help people at end of life.
Do you think that at some point you would do it full time?
No. I don't know. Who knows, isn't it? I don't know. I think I'd like to, but yeah, you know, it's whether there's enough call for it in my area, whether I'm destined to work in a different part of that area, maybe more educational, as that's my background. But if I can just get the conversations going. So with a couple of my friends, we had like a death dinner. So they come along, I cook a nice meal, we get some cards that just add prompts about death and dying and get conversations going. I think if people can do that, then it's a start.
Yeah.
It's going to happen to us all. The more we can talk about it, the better.
And I do hope that my conversation with Mandy has helped to start some discussions and prompted some of us to think more deeply about death. It certainly has me, and in a very positive way, because so often we avoid those thoughts because we see them as negative, don't we? And if you want to find out more, you can visit the End of Life Doula UK website, which is eol-doula.uk. That's E for Echo, O for Oscar, L for Lima, dash D for Delta, O for Oscar, U for Uniform, L for Lima, and A for Alpha. Candy Statton and Young Hearts Run Free here on Joining the Dots on Hospital Radio Glamorgan, your healthy choice. I'm Julie Kissick. Thanks for your company. Yesterday was International Women's Day, and we had some special programmes to celebrate across the station. Carlene was on air between 10 and 12, and she shared some of her favourite female artists across the 2 hours. And she was flying solo, so big shout out to her for doing that. And I had the 12 till 2 slot. And my guests were Esme Allchurch, wife of the late Ivor, one of Wales's greatest ever footballers. Also, Jane Ludlow, the former Wales women's manager and one of our country's most decorated footballers. And I also shared the programme with someone who, up until fairly recently, hadn't achieved fame, but after being one of the 22 of the last series of The Traitors on the BBC, and the only one to wear the red secret traitor cloak, she has most definitely been catapulted into the spotlight. She is, of course, Fiona Hughes. And you can catch the full 2 hours of my show and the full 2 hours of Carlene's on the Hospital Radio Glamorgan Rewind Player on our website or on our app. And I'll play you a taster of the conversations that I had after Lady Gaga and Shallow. So, Esme Allchurch talks about what International Women's Day means to her. Jane Ludlow spoke about the women who've influenced and continue to influence her. And Fiona Hughes told me about the role the women in her life have had, especially in helping to facilitate her love of football.
Oh, well, it just means to me how life has improved so much for women, you know, sort of over 90 years of life. I've seen such an improvement because when I was young, women were more or less second-class citizens. They weren't accepted into top jobs. They were mostly having to be housewives, which I found the hardest job I've ever done in my life. But it was just married women weren't considered for big jobs, good jobs, even though they may have been well-educated and able to do the jobs. But I think the war changed that a lot, started changing then. I was 5 when war broke out, so I saw the change then. You know, women had to do the jobs because the men had gone to fight more, and then people found out, oh, they can do it as well as the men. But the trouble was, when the war was over, the men came back and reclaimed the jobs. So even like just teaching, whereas married women could teach during the war because of the men fighting. When they came back, they had to give up their jobs because of the men coming back from fighting, which was fair enough. But, you know, that soon changed again. So that was just the one example I thought of, because of course it happened with my teachers. So yes, and nowadays you find that women, I don't think fully are accepted, but more or less accepted. You know, you've got so many GPs that are women, you've got lawyers, accountants, everywhere in life now women have got really good jobs.
But I think my mind also goes to all the fabulous female leaders, coaches that have influenced me, whether that was as a player or now as a coach or a leader of a system, and just the inspiration I get from people close to me and the systems I work in. But also obviously on a global scale and the higher profile women in the world who are doing great things and who are influencing positive change around the world, whether that's sport or non-sport in environments. But I go one more layer to it on a daily basis. I mean, you can go into a supermarket and you can see some great female leadership on show. So I'm very much a person that looks closer to home with inspiration and seeing positive behaviours and how people lead and impact people. So sorry, not a clean answer there with the one person. Starts with my mum, but goes far wider. Like any female in the world today who is having a positive impact on change and thinking of the next generation coming through, lots of admiration for those people.
I was brought up with 3 brothers in Morriston. And I had one brother who was massively into rugby. Another brother who loved football, and another brother who was brilliant at all sports. But my mother was always a passionate Swans fan because her younger brother, Billy Rees, played for the Swans, and I played for Wales as a youth. I had an auntie who lived in Glamorgan Street, 2 doors away from the players' entrance, that I used to stay with her quite a lot. Players in the 60s weren't like they are today. They weren't superstars, you know. I'd be out our little front garden and we'd be clapping and cheering. They'd always come over and say, "Hello, Rona, how are you?" Because she was also the tea lady. And then I bought a little house in William Street opposite the Clarence Pub. I was nursing at the time. My next door neighbours, Betty and Alwyn, lived in 32 William Street, next door to the Swan Shop. But if I was a morning shift and I'd get home late, you'd know how the Swans were doing, because the cheering from the newsstand would be overwhelming. So I loved it there. And then when Gwyn and I got together, Rhys was 6 weeks old when I took him to his first match. And he stayed half a match, and then I ran out and deposited him with Betty, my mother-in-law, in number 32 William Street, and then run back to see the other half.
And you can hear those interviews in full via the Hospital Radio Glamorgan Rewind on our website or the Hospital Radio Glamorgan app. And don't forget, if dancing and sparkles and all the glamour of Strictly Come Dancing are your thing, do consider supporting the 10 of Us Strictly Speakeasy event, which is taking place a week on Friday, that's March the 20th, at the Coal Exchange in Cardiff Bay. Strictly Come Dancing's Kai Widdrington and Katia Jones will be there. All the details are available on the 10 of Us website. That's 10ofuscancercare.org.uk and then / easy for me to say, Strictly Speak Easy. And that's just about it from me. I'm back on Friday at 6 o'clock for my usual All About Sport, and I'll have a Six Nations preview. How will Wales fare against a resurgent Italy? Plus the latest from Cardiff City and Newport County. So join me then if you can, but do keep it here on Hospital Radio Glamorgan, your healthy choice.
We're your healthy choice. We are Hospital Radio Glamorgan.